Okay, so this started out as an invitation for an informal talk, and I hope that is how it is perceived. And if there are any topics promised in the abstract which are not delivered, then please let me know, although the topics are here. And in fact, I'm going to talk about... what am I going to talk about? Okay. But I am going to talk about the work of these students who have done some excellent work in various weak probes of the nucleus, and okay, strong interactions are important. There are a lot of processes that we observe or can only observe by using bound states of the strong interaction for both practical and physical reasons, and we need to understand the structure of nucleons and nuclei for dark matter searches, for short and long baseline neutrino oscillation studies, and for sorting out what is known as the proton radius puzzle or the Rydberg constant puzzle. And I'll talk about each of these three different probes of the nucleon and the nucleus. And in each case, I'll try to give enough background to say why the problem is important, and then focus on one theory topic that is either directly relevant or has been inspired by these three problems. So in WIMP nucleus scattering, I'll talk about heavy quark decoupling relations at n cubed LO that turn out to be numerically relevant. And there are some interesting sum rule constraints and recursion relations that this problem highlighted. Neutrino nucleus scattering analyticity is very important. I'll make a connection to P versus NP computing in this case, and the Rydberg constant puzzle. There are some interesting things in heavy particle effective field theories that happened first at order 1 over m to the fourth, and this puzzle has motivated looking at 1 over m to the fourth in general heavy particle effective field theories. Okay, so whether your interest is in the applications or in some of these theoretical ideas, it's part of the same broad class of ideas. And more generally, the interaction of hadronic physics with radiative corrections is becoming more and more important in many so-called intensity frontier processes. Okay, so heavy WIMPs. We're interested in making predictions that tell us where to look in next generation searches in underground direct detection experiments. So just as we can say things about axions based on the Pecci-Quinn mechanism without wedding ourselves to a particular model, we can say things about how WIMPs interact with nuclei without knowing the detailed ultraviolet completion of a particle physics model. And in particular, when that WIMP becomes heavy compared to standard model particles, especially the electroweak vector bosons, heavy particle effective field theory can be used to make universal predictions. So I'll focus on an electroweak triplet that we can call the basic WIMP and simply ask, what is the cross-section for a basic WIMP to scatter off of a nucleon or a nucleus? This can be a WINO, a composite pion-like object, or given other names. There's a heavy WIMP spin symmetry. It doesn't matter if it's a scalar particle or a Majorana fermion, etc. And there's an answer for that cross-section in the limit of large mass. Okay, why the limit of large mass? LHC is not telling us any one thing, but it is not telling us definitively that new physics is light is a safe statement. And perhaps new physics is somewhat heavy. So in the paradigm where there is a lot of stuff potentially going on at the electroweak scale, we may be looking at a different paradigm where the lightest new physics state is somewhat heavy compared to the weak scale. And in this situation, unless there's a fine tuning or other reason why the next lightest state is within order MW of the first lightest state, there will be a scale separation between this guy and this guy. We can integrate out the states one by one, and the physics is dominated by the lightest beyond the standard model.
Electric multiplet. The scale of the mass of the weak scales as along with the multiplets, PSM multiplets that you're talking here. Is that true? Here you assume there is a separation of scale. So WIMPMA, so here you assume that both the light states that are charged on the thermal mode and the WIMPMAs are heavy. It could be the, like, could be some other issue. Could be the WIMP is light and these things are still heavy, right?
I would say that everything can be anything unless it's something else.
So you just focus on this. No, it's fine. Putting
a measure on the parameter space of new physics models is not easy. But just as there are some universal predictions for example, the simplest axion parameter space, this gives a parameter space for a simple class of WIMPs, and of course one can make it less simple iteratively.
The Lux experiments of TEV, did they come up to, especially the big Lux coming up this year, next year?
I think I'll give a projection and exclusion plot that we can discuss, but they don't. What they present and what they could present is a different question, but they go up to the mass that is relevant for such heavy WIMPs. If you're motivated by thermal relic abundance arguments, then that points to TEV mass range, and with a universal prediction for the cross section, and it I'll show the results for where that compares to projections.
They go up to quite a nice TEV mass.
Again, what they present in plots and what they could present in plots can be a different question, but I'll show that plot and we can discuss. Yeah. Okay, so just like a electron interacts with a nucleus in a universal way. It doesn't know, for example, whether it's dealing with a hydrogen nucleus or a deuteron nucleus until it probes power corrections. And similarly, light quarks interact with heavy quarks in a universal way up to power corrections. Similarly, dark matter provides a source of electroweak SU2 cross U1 in this class of models, and we can throw a nucleus at such a static source of electroweak SU2 and see what the scattering cross-section is. It's a surprisingly intricate problem. This is the Lagrangian, and we're going to focus simply on the first term here as a static source, but it is interesting to notice that if we went to higher order in the 1 over m expansion, there are relatively few free parameters through order 1 over m cubed. There's two numbers, a mass and a charge radius, plus polarizabilities. Interactions with standard model fields beyond the gauge forces, similarly constrained, and at leading order in 1 over m, a single number that parameterizes the power corrections. Everything is suppressed by 1 over m, and so the leading prediction is universal, and we can calculate. Two-loop corrections are numerically relevant, and heavy Wimp-Feynman rules simplify the calculations. So there's a bit of heavy lifting involved to compute these diagrams for the relevant matching calculation. The matching is onto dimension 4 quark and gluon operators that are spin 0 and spin 2, just with different Lorentz indices. And one can perform those matching calculations with these diagrams. And that heavy lifting is necessary if you were to do just a dimensional estimate on the back of an envelope. You would obtain an estimate which is in the range of 10 to the minus 45 centimeters squared, for example. And again, if you're motivated by thermal relic abundance, this should be in the few TeV mass range. However, there is an amplitude level cancellation that becomes clear and is universal, and that pushes the WIMP cross section close to the so-called neutrino floor.
Yeah, this is for the Higgs mass. This is the crazy Higgs mass constellation. This is for a Guino dark matter, basically, right?
Correct.
The constellation comes between what and what?
Between the amplitudes for the spin zero operators and the spin two operators. And I'll show a plot versus Higgs mass that makes that more clear.
And it's like the 125 was designed to
and even more unfortunate in a Higgsino like quantum number.
It's even worse for Higgsinos.
So there's really only an upper bound on the cross section. It's consistent with zero.
Oh my god.
But is this a recent result? Because I was, I remember a bit different numbers for the. So is it a new result or because I?
These are the current results.
These are the current results.
Of order a year or so ago.
You can show it.
There were some sign errors, right, in the original papers. And then,
so, is this a paper by the Japanese people or your paper?
I'm referring to our paper.
Your paper.
Which is.
Solon, right?
Yes.
Solon, the student.
Correct.
Yeah. And,
so, remind us, Richard, that the spin 2 was ignored in the earlier papers, right? And the sign was wrong between 1 over W squared and 1 over D squared.
Yeah, what was going on? Look, it's an informal. You can, let's give a long linear talk so you can skip ahead.
It's informal, but I'm being recorded.
You can turn off the.
Yeah, yeah. God obeys us.
You can say that we can throw away all our own papers in the garbage, so that's except yours. That's fine.
So it's not a simple exercise to go through incomplete calculations, everything is safe on this slide if you simply stick in. A scaling argument for the number of powers of coupling constants and masses and so on. This is the type of answer you would get. And that is the type of answer you would get if you were to not do a complete calculation.
They had the relative sign wrong between the box and the Higgs.
And there's some treatment of the matrix elements that mixed up spin 0 and spin 2, things of this nature.
The plot of Schoen is more or less like this. Okay.
So for the Higgs here, it's almost 0.
Okay, and of course, when something is extremely small due to an accidental cancellation, then other effects can come in. And so, for example, Chen Yi is looking at power corrections, especially for Higgsino. Could be significant, and nuclear effects beyond the single nucleon approximation potentially could impact this spin zero, spin two cancellation.
Oh, But how, I don't understand the ladder though, because bees are very heavy, so the Broglie weight, the relevant is momentum to change, to see how much of the nucleus you have. Yeah, okay, could be. Yeah, okay, sorry.
It's a non-trivial problem, and
yeah.
There are efforts to do a serious job of that. Okay, so there are a few aspects of this. There are many scales involved in the calculation, and you can separate those scales in effective field theory analysis. Mm-hmm. So let me focus on having gotten into the effective field theory with five-flavor QCD. We can match that by a series of RG running and threshold quark matching steps to get down to three-flavor QCD with matrix elements that we can compute in lattice QCD or other non-perturbative methods. Okay, so this is a sample. Once we're in that effective field theory, we're agnostic to whether this came from this heavy Wino-like dark matter or some other candidate. I'm going to focus on the operators that are relevant for that case. Again, these are dimension 4 QCD operators, and the scalar operators are the ones that I'll focus on. These are the quark threshold matching relations at the bottom quark or charm quark threshold. The coefficients of these effective operators in the, say, 4-flavor theory can be related by some matrix to the coefficients in the 5-flavor theory. That matrix has this form, and if we're careful about the definition of quark masses in dim reg or related regularization schemes, then we can guarantee that these coefficients are unity, these other coefficients vanish, and we're left with coefficients that are related to a certain number of them, the MQ capital Q and MG capital Q, and others that are constrained by some row relations from the stress energy tensor of QCD. Okay, and now some of these have been calculated and some of them haven't. For example, Higgs coupling to heavy quarks makes the coupling and to the heavy quark and integrating out that heavy quark a very relevant exercise, and that exercise has been taken to high order. However, we're interested in a theory that starts with a coupling to gluons, so J can be the gluon operator, and we want to ask what operators are induced by that starting point. And that starting point has not been analyzed to high order. Okay, so these coefficients are known through three loops with a smart choice of regularization scheme. Others are trivial or are fixed by these recursion relations following from the sum rule. And that gives new results for these gluon-induced coefficients in the four-flavor theory. And just to see that some of that heavy lifting is necessary if we were to do leading order in renormalization and threshold matching, you would get the result that cannot be seen.
Because it looks like, I was like, what is the problem?
Okay, but there's a shape that looks like this, but is over here.
Oh, that's the leading order, right?
Okay, that is the leading order, and the higher order QCD corrections result in the red curve. And for the physical value of the Higgs mass, you're sitting here, and you would have been in this unfortunate situation to have only an upper bound, but you are now in the situation that you have a prediction. And that prediction, as you can see, is a small prediction that results from a cancellation between the spin 0 and spin 2 amplitudes. It would be a perfect cancellation for a Higgs mass of about 100 GeV. And in the Higgsino-like quantum number case, this cancellation region happens very close to the physical Higgs mass.
But even the leading order is really small compared to the original back of the envelope estimate is where on here? It's somewhere up there.
Yeah, 10 to the minus 44 it was.
So why is the leading order so far off?
45, perhaps. So it's an amplitude cancellation that happens at something like the 10% level, mm-hmm. and 10% squared is the couple order of magnitude suppression.
And the cancellation with the Higgs happens exactly when? Was it 100 and not 90? So this is the one loop where you have the, what is it, W and Z exchange in the loop, W in the loop. And then there's the Higgs loop, right? The cancellation between
there
those
is,
two.
There is a box diagram.
The box diagram.
There is a Higgs diagram.
Yes.
That's the way to cancel, right?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily one diagram canceling against another diagram, but the total spin zero amplitude for all parameter values is one sign, and the total spin two amplitude is another sign, and the Higgs only contributes to the spin zero amplitude.
So if the Higgs was 200 GeV, you would have the cancellation anyway or not?
If the Higgs was 200 GeV,
just the same number. So if
it's gone, it's
yeah, it wouldn't happen. Happen.
You wouldn't have.
Well, it doesn't happen right now either.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'll show a similar plot also with the matrix elements here. Okay, so once we're in three-flavor QCD, we still need to take matrix elements with nucleons and then the usual coherent form factor for the nuclear correction or a more sophisticated calculation. Okay, and we can view that as a series of steps, in principle, first onto a chiral effective field theory with pions, and then integrating up pions to yield just the nucleons. Okay, there's a complete basis of operators that are relevant for most dark matter interactions you could conceive of, and I'll focus on the ones again relevant to the heavy WIMP case. And it is these spin two operators that are determined by moments of PDFs, and these scalar operators that require non-perturbative calculation in three-flavor QCD. So there's a lot of effort from the lattice community, and this is actually a very concrete example of lattice QCD contributing to new physics searches. The precise size of this error bar is a matter of debate. But the point is that this is a relatively small value.
This is MS as bar S. MS is missing.
MS is missing. Thank you. Okay, so MS, S bar S, was previously thought to have a large value inside the nucleon, and it contribute significant fraction to the nucleon mass. If one were to use the inputs that one obtained from SU3 predictions of the baryon spectrum, one would obtain the blue curve. These are again for the Wino-like quantum numbers. And this is now the full RG and threshold matching case. And using these matrix elements would have give the unfortunate answer of zero for this dark matter. However, the modern lattice QCD inputs give the red curve, again with the cancellation region happening over here. Okay, so
we should track the light.
Again, it's a matter of debate, the precise size of this error bar, but the point is that this is tens of MeV and not hundreds of MeV.
And the sigma term that reproduces well,
right? Probably some interesting questions one can ask there, but I'm not aware of contradiction with data. So these are relatively easy lattice calculations that one can approach using a Feynman-Hellerman theorem for the sigma terms in terms of varying the quark mass.
Sigma term on my memory oscillates. So it's a variable in time. It sometimes goes higher, sometimes goes lower. I hope the oscillation stops, right? Because if it doesn't, you know, the lattice will drift towards the new value, and your cancellation region may change as well.
Okay. There are some interesting things to say with C bar C matrix elements as well, and there are some backup slides here that we can discuss. Okay, so these are then the final values with the best inputs with both perturbative and non-perturbative QCD. This is the triplet Wino-like case that we've been discussing. This is the doublet Higgs-Eno-like case where the cancellation happens in the vicinity of the physical Higgs mass. Okay, and again, you put that on a projection plot, and the triplet case is certainly a target for next or next to next generation searches.
So for the doublet, you're assuming that's a pure doublet and only split by the weak connections. What are you assuming for the Higgsian?
It is split into Majorana combinations, and the size of the splitting is otherwise irrelevant.
What if Majorana? So you're adding. So the mass of the charged, how does it compare with the mass of the neutral guy? Is it Dirac? This is what I'm asking. This is not Dirac.
If it's Dirac, it's a school.
Yes, exactly, by law. So here, this is Majorana.
So the WIMP itself is a Majorana particle.
Yeah, but thinking that in the... No, true, but in the loop, what enters the exchange doublet is also the mass of the charge guy, right?
Or he's saying that the splitting is...
I think the fact that it's Majorana will not matter for the...
Unless the splitting is much smaller than the mass, so it doesn't matter. Probably.
Which is explicitly the assumption, not the assumption.
Yeah.
I mean, the starting point is a Dirac doublet of hypercharge 1/2.
Yeah.
But then one assumes, as usual, that there is a splitting such that the lightest state is Majorana.
Yeah.
And, but otherwise, that splitting is not relevant.
Yes.
So there is something else.
I mean, there.
Is impossible.
We can talk about other extensions, for example, with a singlet, and then there's an interplay of the tree level Higgs exchange that you can get with the singlet in the theory versus the power correction. If that singlet is assumed heavy and so on.
Right. The experiment is actually expected to get down to 10 to minus 50 centimeters squared. Then how much in that cash do you need to do this?
The short answer is a lot, and probably not to your second and first question. But this is a good idea. Certainly there's a good question whether you should view this as an absolute floor, etc. One can worry about that when you get there. So this is certainly a target. And then the other thing to say is that this is the universal prediction in the large mass limit. And given that the cancellation is so severe, one should ask about subleading corrections and their size. And we are asking about subleading corrections and their size. And there will be a model dependence to those subleading corrections that, for the Higgs-Eno-like case, would be potentially quite large.
I'm asking a naive question. How much xenon gas do you need to get down to train your background?
This experiment may be never, right? I mean, it depends on the background, right? You have to control the background.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this
I mean, there's more ton stuff.
Well, there are ton scale now, and so you can size up you know, linearly, assuming. You can size up, you know, based on your assumptions. But these are experiments where every time you get to the next level of sensitivity, you find backgrounds that you need to study before going further. Well, it's an upper bound, so it is, in this region. Again, in the, the universal limit of large mass.
Of the large mass of the Higgs zero.
Correct.
Large, you mean, it has to be large for the Lita Banas term.
Right, so I mean, for the Wino, even given the presence of this amplitude level cancellation, one can estimate the size of the power corrections, and it should not change things qualitatively, although it should be studied. For the Higgs Zeno, that is very likely not the case. If the cancellation is really so severe, then the subleading corrections are likely relevant. And let me just flip to the maybe a problem at the end there. I have many backup slides that we can talk about. I was hoping that it would pop out. Okay, that's the one I was looking for. So if you one can look at various combinations, and then as a function of couplings and mass splittings, one can see what next generation experiments will bite off.
Wait, so Bayer-Higgs zero, so this is spin independent, and pure doubling
goes
that way. Okay, yeah, I guess.
So what is being plotted here? This is mass splitting between the lightest guy and the other guy in units of MW, basically. And so as that mass splitting gets large, you just integrate out the guy that you put in.
The positive is physical.
And so this is the pure Wino case. This is the pure Higgs Zeno case. This is the pure.
Delta should be positive, or
pure.
Singlet.
Singlet, which presumably is going to zero, and this is the pure doublet. And sorry, Maxime.
Delta is positive. For the neutral, I mean, is it the difference between neutral and the charged, or
so this would just be the Higgs Zeno minus Wino. So it's the difference of Higgs Zeno minus Wino, or Higgs Zeno minus Bino in the two cases.
Is this the cross-section difference between the two neutrals, or neutral and charged?
Between the electroweak symmetric mass that is put in at a high scale. Which up to power corrections is just the mass of the neutrals. In those multiplets.
Both
signs are physical, just by definition.
Yeah. Are you assuming that the parameter space you're showing everything is thermal, or are you just finding that parameter?
No, this is just the universal cross section giving this particle, assuming that it sits here.
The pure doublet, however, the cross section goes back again because it's excluded by the Z exchange. Probably you don't see any challenge because you think of it as an elastic, but when delta becomes. If it's really pure doublet, it very much be excluded.
Yeah, but that happens at very large splittings.
No, it's small, zero.
No, this is the Bino-Higgs-Zeno splitting. It's not the splitting between the...
Ah, very good. So,
as the splitting becomes, because so this is the decoupling limit for the Bino, is very large splitting. And then
when you set that to infinity, that is excluded.
No, no, of course, yes. And I'm saying that this can happen with a bin of MD, I don't know, I mean, at let's say 10,
what
100 TeV,
yeah.
And you still have enough, 100, you need 100 KV.
100 KV, exactly.
Yeah, something like that,
yes.
Right?
So this band should turn around.
Yes.
At some point, it turns around.
Yes.
I've given you my assumptions, and then one can analyze the models. Very good. Okay. So, yeah, the basic WIMP is in the red. Perturbative, non-perturbative QCD, very relevant.
So you're basically saying that Xenon is useless. This is so loaded.
You know, but it's not useless, right? It can't be done matter. The problem is we cannot find it. Not even at the end. It's like a slap in the face. You go to the NHC, you cannot find. You go to the ray detection hoping, you cannot find. And it's a very simple dark matter problem.
Maybe in
but some people say that the triplet is excluded by
indirect
detection. Some people say that they find a triplet at least is excluded
yes,
by indirect detection.
See, the triplet, the other advantage of the triplet is that, yeah, it is excluded. The reason is it's heavier when you get thermal advantage, so it's closer to 3 TeV. And there, the background from cosmic rays is lower compared to 1 TeV, which is for the Higgsino, the thermal energy advantage.
I'm not sure if that helps you, because if it's heavier, then the density is smaller. So
no, but what helps you is because the background drops faster, so you can see the line much more easily. And this is why Hess was... This is where the statement comes that the pure triplet is basically excluded.
Mm. Not everybody agrees about it.
No, because it depends a lot on the profile that you assume. If you assume one very flat profile, it's still okay. It's annihilation, so it goes like n squared. So basically, they exclude the most popular profile. Who knows? And for the Higgsino, it's just that it's very hard to see because the background is so high from cosmic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Annihilation also very interesting. Subject of another talk.
Oh, okay.
I want to say some things about neutrinos. And I have this, two-pronged approach. So I'll say a quirky theoretical thing, but there's the absolutely compelling phenomenological motivation, which is neutrino cross-sections for a variety of interesting things that can only be probed by oscillation or other non-collider experiments. And there are a lot of aspects of QCD that go into this problem, and I'll focus on one. So cross-sections are important. They were important for actually knowing that there was a solar neutrino puzzle before Snow helped solve the solar neutrino puzzle. So in order to know that there wasn't enough NUIs arriving at the Earth, one needed to know how many should have been produced in the Sun, and we now understand this as neutrino mass manifestation, where the charge and mass eigenstates are not the same. Similarly, in our accelerator-based neutrino experiments, we need to know the cross-sections for similarly basic reasons, that in the simplest picture, we start with a flux of nu mu neutrinos, and we want to see how many of those appear as new E's after traversing a long baseline. And so we can find the event rate, but we need to know the cross-section in order to know the flux. And that cross-section depends on a number of things. The basic signal process is charge current scattering on a neutron bound inside of a nucleus. And that cross-section is impacted by radiative corrections by the hadronic amplitudes at the nucleon level and by nuclear effects, and all of it has to be gotten right. Okay, and we need to know the energy very well, and we need to know the cross-section very well. So what is plotted here is, in black is, roughly speaking, the new mu's that we have at our disposal. This is in a Dune LBNF like beam with the event number on the left-hand axis, and then as a function of various neutrino parameters, the different colored bands give the predictions for Nui appearance with the numbers on the right-hand axis. Okay, so one needs to know cross sections precisely, and one needs to be able to reconstruct energy precisely to sort that all out. And there are many applications at many energies, and I'll focus on GeV scale energies for the long baseline and short baseline experiments. Okay, so the basic signal process is nu plus neutron goes to charged lepton plus proton. And there's one aspect of that amplitude that we don't know well enough. And so we're in an era where we're revisiting a lot of things that have not been revisited since the 1970s and 80s. We now have new tools at our disposal, is one of the themes. Okay, so this is a plot of the different contributions to neutrino nucleon and neutrino nucleus scattering as a function of energy. And we're in the regime here. We're just using the oscillation formula and the baselines we have at our disposal. We have GeV scale neutrino beams, and the so-called quasi-elastic component is a prominent contribution at this energy. RES is a resonance production where you produce something like a delta that decays into pion plus nucleon, which is also relevant at this energy scale. Okay, so this simplest amplitude has various components, can be decomposed into invariant form factors, vector form factors that are constrained by electron scattering, a pseudoscalar form factor whose impact is suppressed by lepton mass, and a very relevant axial form factor, which with a few exceptions has been parametrized in a simple dipole ansatz. And I've even managed to make a typo here that the dipole has a square. Okay, precision requirements have outgrown such simple models, and we need to do better. And I'll give you a quirky introduction to the way that we'll do better, which is to find a way of fitting data that avoids NP hard problems. Okay, so suppose we have a quantum mechanical observable. The physical problem is not going to rely on NP hard problems, but it is an interesting observation. Quantum mechanical observable given by a square of an amplitude, suppose that we can Taylor expand that amplitude in some small parameter x. And suppose that we fit some data with points sigma I to the square of that amplitude with some error bars d sigma I. This is a fourth order polynomial in these expansion coefficients. So we want to minimize chi square to manipulate that. And it turns out that minimizing a function that is not known to be convex is a very difficult problem. But determining whether a fourth order polynomial is in fact convex is also an NP hard problem. So we have a hard problem.
NP hard in terms of what's your parameter that you're making large?
The number of expansion coefficients, so the order. So it's it has a product of four of these guys, but I can have an A3, A4, up to A10, et cetera. Yeah.
Until it takes
Okay, so the short story is that our polynomial is special, and provided a certain condition is satisfied, it is convex in the physically relevant region. So as long as the prediction times 3 is bigger than the experimentally measured value, in other words, as long as the errors are not order 1, then chi-squared is convex in that region. And we can simply roll to the minimum, and it's an efficient numerical problem that is borne out in practice. Okay, the proof is trivial and is just given by recognizing that a sum of convex functions is convex, and such a function is convex if the Hessian is positive definite, and one can simply compute the Hessian for this function, and it has the form of a positive definite thing times this factor, and that factor being positive is the physical condition. Okay, so unfortunately all of that is not relevant unless we can Taylor expand in some variable. This is the complex plane, and this is the singularity structure of the amplitude we're trying to expand. It has a branch cut singularity starting at physical particle thresholds. This would be the 3 pion threshold for the axial vector form factor. The physical region is in the blue, and we can't simply, for example, Taylor expand around q squared equals to 0 because the function is not analytic with domain of analyticity big enough to cover the physical region. But we can map the domain of analyticity, which is the cut plane, onto the unit circle by this unique up to choice of phase and the point that maps onto z equals 0 conformal transformation. So the physical region becomes a line segment. Since it doesn't touch this threshold or extend to infinity, it doesn't touch the unit circle here. Therefore, you found a number less than 1. And in practice, it turns out to be somewhat small. And we can expand keeping as many coefficients as we like to obtain the precision that we want. Okay, so that strategy has been applied to a large number of processes in a large number of fields, including heavy meson physics, electron scattering, and now neutrino scattering. Okay, and this may not sound exciting, but being able to put a robust systematic error on this form factor is a big deal in the neutrino cross-section game. Okay, we can find how many coefficients are relevant, and in fact, only the first one is measured to be non-zero from the data we're fitting to. I'm happy to talk about more details of this deuterium bubble chamber analysis. This is the most precise data we have to constrain this form factor. It was data taken in bubble chambers in the 1970s and 80s. So we can just pick off these coefficients and keeping as many terms as we need to describe the data, and we have error correlations and so on. And from that, we can predict things like the axial radius of the nucleon, single nucleon cross-sections, nuclear cross-sections. That's implemented in the neutrino Monte Carlos now and can be made to make predictions over a broad range of observables. For the proton radius puzzle aficionados, it has conventionally been assumed that the axial radius of the nucleon is known as precisely or more precisely than the charge radius of the proton, which at face value seems rather bizarre since there is much less data for the axial form factor, and that data involves neutrino beams with poorly determined flux and detectors with poor resolution. A reasonable assignment of error, in fact, makes that more reasonable. And in fact, the error is quite large and motivates new measurements that we can discuss. Okay, so that's dark matter and neutrinos. Atoms.
So this RA is like the direct analog of RT in the axial channel?
Yes, it's
and so the
slope of the form factor.
Whatever the meson models, do they have like some predictions? I mean, the atomic models.
There are models, but values that have been used have come from FITS2, the deuterium data, using a dipole ansatz, or FITS2 pion electroproduction data.
There would be some sort of intermediate axial vector boson
Not sure the question you're asking. So if you simply fit the data, you don't need model except to.
What I'm saying is that if I'm completely oblivious to things, I could try to probably model RP by the vector dominance model, and I could get something like this. It's not going to be
sure.
A crazy value, right? So it's like this is a larger. This is a smaller value than RP squared, right? That corresponds to the fact that axial vector bosons would be paired.
Yes, so making any of that precise is. Difficult or impossible, but yeah, the picture is that you can certainly write a dispersion relation, and so it's the sum of some effective poles of axial vector mesons. However, in order to get a dipole, you of course need to fiddle with two such poles, but roughly speaking, an axial vector meson has greater than one GeV mass, and the picture is that in this formula, where I've misplaced the factor 2, this is an axial vector meson mass, and hence the name MA. Okay, and there are interesting things one can say about the perturbative behavior of this form factor. We know it falls like 1 over q to the 4th at large space like q squared, and that implies a series of sum rules on these coefficients, since q going to space like infinity and z going to 1, mm-hmm. and so on.
So is that the Weinberg sum rule?
I don't believe there's a direct relation to Weinberg sum rules, which are relations of different dispersion relations, correct? So. You take quark counting arguments that tell you the form factor goes like 1 over q to the 4th.
Yeah.
And
then you discover that it's mass convergence a certain way.
And so if this thing vanishes as q squared goes to space like infinity, mm-hmm. then if I set z equals to 1, I must get that a0 plus a1 plus a2 plus dot 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 equals 0. And I can also show that various derivatives of this, and hence different sums like a0 plus 1 times a1 plus 2 times a2 and so on, that those sum rules add to 0. So those are the sum rules that I'm speaking of. The words Goldman and Dreeman are not necessary for the things I've said, but if you find them to be useful, I'm happy. Okay, so here's the bonus joke slide. Okay. These are facts, these are not jokes, but there is a joke that comes along with the facts. Okay, so a fact about this Rydberg constant puzzle. You can also call it the proton radius puzzle, but the Rydberg constant puzzle is simply emphasizing that this is a fundamental constant or combination of standard model parameters. It has only one value in the standard model, and if different experiments get different values, there is something wrong. So it's a puzzle. It's generated a lot of attention and controversy, and the most mundane resolution emphasizing that the most mundane is not mundane, it's simply the most mundane, involves a five sigma or so shift in the Rydberg constant and discarding or revising decades of results in electron scattering and hydrogen spectroscopy. Okay, so as a particle theorist, you may say that this is not your problem until these scattering guys and these atomic guys work things out. And I maintain that that is not a viable alternative. This is particle physics problem for a variety of reasons, including the fact that systematic effects, if this is due to systematic effects, impact neutrino nucleus scattering at a level large compared to current and future neutrino experiments. So we need to figure this out. And we shouldn't be willy-nilly changing fundamental constants by phi sigma.
But the last part of the particle community belongs to the camp that will say, well, we don't care about you either, right? So that's
it's another conversation. It's our direct access to very high scales. Okay, so the logical options are then an issue in muonic hydrogen. This would require an incredibly large shift compared to any known experimental systematic. It would otherwise involve shifts in both electronic hydrogen and electron scattering. And this is the scenario with a five sigma shift in the Rydberg constant. It could be a structure effect in muonic hydrogen. With other ramifications, and four makes this logically safe, being something else. Okay, scattering. Gabriel Lee was here last year. Some of you might have even seen him give a talk on the subject of a reanalysis of the scattering data. This is a summary. Plotted here is the radius in Fermi. Muonic hydrogen is this very precise value here. Combination of regular hydrogen is in this gray band. The A1 data set from 2010 is the highest statistics data, and this is the A1 fit to that data. This series of black points is a series of improvements of our fit to that same data with revised systematics, obtaining the final result in the blue, performing the same procedure to world data minus the Mainz data gives the blue, and a naive average gives the red. Okay, so an indication that there might be more to that story is this plot that shows not just the number, but the number as a function of the amount of data that was included in the fit. So this is the maximum momentum transfer included in the fit. This is the radius in Fermi. This is a central value in one sigma error band. And again, the radius from a scattering is obtained by taking the slope of the form factor, because we simply define the radius as the slope of that form factor. Okay, so this central value, you can see, tends to become larger as you include the higher Q-squared data. The five sigma discrepancy is between the central value, including all of the data, which extended to Q-squared of order GeV squared. And we also pointed out that better treatment of radiative corrections is required. Conservative estimate of the size of subleading radiative corrections is obtained by these blue lines, which can be viewed as a renormalization group scale variation given the corrections that were included.
Basically, the one sigma is the blue that you have up there.
With that error bar, the one sigma would be the blue. Okay, so this and a number of other problems, both in neutrinos and in dark matter and in electron scattering, motivate a class of radiative corrections that can be analyzed in soft collinear effective theory. For neutrinos, this is especially important because it impacts electrons more than muons. These are large Zhdukov logarithms, momentum transfer divided by electron mass inside of a logarithm. Electron mass is very small, and these effects are very important. That's plotted here. This is QED. It is a small coupling, but that small coupling gets multiplied by a large logarithm squared in first order. And so the first order calculation is in the black. That's already a 30% correction for GV squared momentum transfer. Second order compared to first order also has a large difference, and these need to be systematically resummed. Okay, so that wasn't the thing that I wanted to talk about. And given that it's already 2 p.m., how about if I say the thing that I want to talk about, and then you can ask questions?
Sorry, so you were saying before, remind me, you guys look more recently than that. So in order to fix the discrepancy in the measurement of the proton radius from ionic hydrogen, you also needed to change the hydrogen, ordinary hydrogen precision data, right? So this is not enough. Is this enough to fix the discrepancy between between the measure, the experiment and the...
No.
Okay, yeah.
No, so that's part of the reason why it is such a puzzle.
But now, does this mean, though, that the significance of the discrepancy is reduced?
I don't think I have further words that I want to say today on record.
Okay.
But there are certainly systematic effects in the scattering data. And it is well known also that in the electronic hydrogen, this, you know, five sigma discrepancy is not the result of a single measurement, but rather the combination of many different measurements, and there could be correlations that have not been fully accounted for. Okay, the idea being that to get the proton radius and the Rydberg constant, you need two things, and you have the extremely well-measured 1s, 2s, and you need some other hydrogen interval. And so that plot would give an overview of the some of the various intervals that have gone into that average. So it's the that by itself doesn't say anything. Of course, if these are Gaussian error bars, then one can combine them and one gets the pink error bar.
But then this is not, this looks like
and there.
The point people make is certain important lines were measured by one bar, so there could be a correlated systematic.
This is
it's not like it's 1, 2, 3, well, I mean, 10 different points, and it's done by 10 different people, right?
I see.
Some of that is done in one lab, right?
I see.
So we might have further news this summer. We'll see.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah.
And then we can talk more off record.
Okay. Because it's past 2, I have to take a Skype. Sorry.
Okay. So there's one fun thing that I just want to mention, and we can talk later. Okay. So this there's two sides of this proton radius puzzle. One is the scattering side. One is the bound state side. And the bound state side, there are, you know, many corrections done over the years by many people. Some of them involve proton structure, and this has motivated high order NRQED. And the short story here is that it motivated looking at 1 over m to the 4th in RQED, and interesting things happen with respect to an almost conflict of gauge invariance and Lorentz symmetry at this order in analogy to the almost conflict of gauge invariance and chiral symmetry in a chiral Lagrangian at 4 derivative order. Okay, so one can build a Lorentz invariant field theory based on finite dimensional representations and one can ask, is this all we need? And this is the statement of a good textbook and that statement is incorrect.
You wind it?
Sure. It's a statement from a very good textbook. okay, so it's very good. So we there are many cases that have only a heavy particle description. So if we want to describe a proton, we simply cannot describe that by anything but a heavy particle effective theory. And if we want to do that and not violate Lorentz invariance, we need to know how to enforce Lorentz invariance in such an effective theory. And maybe I can summarize just by saying that induced representations are the tool to do that. And we have done that. Well, tell me what you guys want to do. Do you guys want 5 minutes or do you want to break for coffee and blackboard? Yeah, so what is an induced representation? So that is mapping Lorentz into rotations. We know how to represent rotations and hence we know how to represent Lorentz. And these type of induced representations are what we should use on our heavy particle fields because we've integrated out the antiparticle component. We only have enough components left to implement rotations on. And we can understand how to build a Lorentz invariant theory based on that. I'm going to refer you to my slides and to that paper, but I want to point out that there's an open problem here. And that open problem is an all-order solution to what we call the invariance equation. Okay, so this is the transformation law for our heavy particle fields is this rotation matrix D. The rotation is the Wigner little group element. That's the reason for the W. That W is a function of the Lorentz transformation that we're doing, lambda, and the momentum or covariant derivative acting on the field. And in order to find Lagrangians that are invariant under this transformation, we can introduce fields that transform in a simpler way, the capital psi fields, where the little psi fields are actually what I should have written up here. And we can write Lagrangians that are invariant easily if we can find such fields, because these fields transform just with a phase. In order to do that, we need to find a solution for this function gamma. That function gamma must satisfy this equation. That equation we can solve order by order in 1 over m, but as yet, an all-order solution is unknown. And I think that's the short summary that I want to leave you with, and then would be happy to discuss further. And then I'll just jump to a summary with some tangents that would be interesting to investigate, and I'd be happy to talk more about these other directions. Three things we talked about: WIMP nucleus scattering. So there's a generic amplitude level cancellation that motivates looking at 1 over m corrections and also nuclear corrections that could distinguish the spin 0 and the spin 2 amplitudes. Operators that have the same one nucleon matrix element may not have the same two nucleon matrix element, and so on. There's more to say about heavy WIMP, effective field theory extended to annihilation, resumming the large Sudokov logarithms that appear there. This is the same type of effective field theory that one uses to resum large logs in electron proton scattering. Neutrino nucleus scattering, FA errors are larger than previously assumed. That motivates new experiments, maybe a hydrogen time projection chamber. Next generation muon capture will have relevant impact. Lattice QCD is coming online and poised to be relevant in this area. It's not a joke to say that Lattice QCD does not have an underground safety hazard, since it is very difficult to perform these experiments with modern safety constraints.
So this is not the neutrino-induced hazard. This is like straight hadron-inducing hazard. So
could you say that again?
What's that?
I didn't hear your question.
I say that the difficulty with the modern views and so on, it's related to the stray patterns interacting with neutrinos, not neutrinos, right? Because neutrino rates are still small.
Sorry, which difficulty are you referring to?
The difficulty, why we cannot replicate the 1970s experiments with the bubble chambers with neutrinos.
So you should talk to the experimentalist to get the definitive answer, but I believe the definitive answer is that you simply cannot take a ball of liquefied hydrogen and put it underground for safety reasons, you know, even on a so-called surface experiment. But I mean, this. It's important to consider this in context, and the context is that we need to know more about this and other amplitudes. And in that context, whether this is completely insurmountable is a valid question. And so one can, you know, do subtractions with water and heavy water and things like this. And one can try to segregate, you know, small volumes of hydrogen and deuterium that put you within guidelines and so on. But I refer those questions to experimental colleagues. Okay, so there are multiple communities with large efforts in neutrino cross sections. Rydberg constant puzzle, interesting to pursue an all-order solution of the invariance equation, perhaps with an interesting geometrical interpretation. A number of experimental efforts underway to shed light on this puzzle, and new sket formalism being developed for radiative corrections. In general, the interplay of radiative corrections and hadronic physics is becoming increasingly important for many processes. And that's the end. Thanks.